at the visual aid. Though the restaurant was warm, the cold was spreading all over my body. I looked between the two men, their different faces. What kind of clairvoyant am I? That is what we want to find out. Over the years I've classified 7 orders of clairvoyance. I believe you, my dear girl, are of the very highest order, making you one of the rarest clairvoyants in the modern world. If I am proved correct. He pulled a folder out of his expensive leather satchel. I'd like you to sign a job contract. His eyes rested on mine. I could write an infinite variety of numbers in this check page. What will it take me to keep you? My heart thumped at my ribs. A drink, for starters. Jackson sat back. Nick, he said, get the young lady some Mex. She's a keeper. Chapter 14. The Sun Rising. For the next few nights, Warden and I did not speak, nor did we train. Every night I would leave as soon as the bell rang, not looking at him as I passed. He would watch, but he would never stop me. I almost wished he would, just so I could let the anger out. One night I tried going to see Liz. It was raining outside, and I longed for the warmth of her stove. But I couldn't. Not after what had happened with Warden. After I'd helped the enemy, again, I couldn't have looked her in the eye. I soon found a new refuge, a place to call my own, an enclosed archway on the steps of the Hawksmoor. It must once have been a majestic structure, but now its grandeur made it tragic. It was cold and heavy, crumbling at the edges, waiting for an age that might never come again. That place became my bolt hole. I went there every night. Sometimes, provided there were no bone grubbers on duty, I would steal into the abandoned library and take a stack of books back to the archway. They had so many illegal novels in there, I started to wonder if this is where Cyan sent them all. Jax would have sold his soul to get his mitts on them, if he had a soul to sell. 4 nights had passed since the bloodletting. I still didn't understand why I'd helped him. What sort of dirty trick was he playing? The thought of my blood inside him made me sick. I couldn't stand to think of what I'd done. The window was ajar. I'd hear them if they came for me. I wouldn't let them sneak up on me, like they had in 1-5. I discovered a book called The Turn of the Screw, hidden among the bookshelves. The rain was heavy. I had elected to stay indoors in the library. I lay prone under a desk and lit a little oil lamp to see the pages. Outside the broad was quiet. Most of the Harleys were starting to practice for the bicentennial celebration. Rumor had it that the Grand Inquisitor himself was due to attend. He had to be impressed by how we were spending our new lives, or he might not allow this special arrangement to continue. Not that he had much choice. Still, we had to show that we were useful, if only for entertainment. That we were worth a little more than it would cost to give us nightkind. I took out the envelope David had given me. Inside was a fragment of a text from a notebook, torn and yellowed. I'd studied it several times. It looked as if a candle had fallen on it. The corners were hard with wax, and a large hole had been burned right through the middle. There was a blurred sketch in the corner of the page, something that must once have been a face, but now looked faded and disfigured. I could only make out the occasional word. Rephaim are creatures in the cold, within, boundaries of, able, limitless periods of time, but new form that hunger, uncontrollable and energy surrounding the purported, red flower, the soul method, nature of the, and only then can. I tried yet again to thread the words together, to find some kind of pattern. It wasn't difficult to link the fragments about hunger and energy, but I couldn't think of what red flower could mean. There was something else in the envelope, too. A faded daguerreotype. The date 1842 had been scrawled on the corner, I looked at it for a long time, but I couldn't make anything out but white smears on black. I tucked the envelope back into my tunic and nibbled on a bit of stale toke. When my eyes grew tired, I blew out the oil lamp and wrapped myself into the fetal position. My mind was a tangle of loose ends. Warden and his injuries. Pleiany bringing him Seb's blood. David and his interest in my welfare. And Nashira, with her all-seeing eyes. I forced myself to think only of Warden. I still tasted bile when I thought of Seb's blood, bottled and labelled, ready for consumption. I hoped they'd taken it when he was still alive, not from his dead body. Then there was Pleiany. She'd brought him the blood. She must have known he was going to contract necrosis, or at least that he might have contracted it. She must have arranged to bring him human blood before it was too late. When she'd been delayed, he drank my blood instead. Whatever he was doing it in her confidence. Warden had a secret. So did I. I was hiding my link to the underworld, one that Nashira no doubt wanted to root out. I could live with his silence if he could live with mine. I traced my bandaged arm. Still the wound refused to heal. To me it was as ugly as the brand. If it scarred, I would never forget the shame and fear I'd felt when I did it. So much like the fear I felt the first time I encountered the spirit world. Fear of what I was, what I could be. I must have drifted off. A sharp pain in my cheek brought me back to reality. Paige. Liss was shaking me. My eyes were raw and puffy.
Paige, what the hell are you doing in here? It's past dawn. There are bone grubbers out looking for you.
I looked up, groggy.
Why?
Because the warden told them to look for you. You were supposed to be at Maudlin an hour ago. She was right. The sky was turning gold. Liss pulled me to my feet.
You're lucky they didn't find you in here. It's forbidden.
How did you find me? I used to come in here myself. She grasped my shoulders, looked me dead in the eyes.
You have to beg the warden's forgiveness. If you beg, he might not punish you.
I almost laughed.
Beg? It's the only way.
I won't beg him for anything.
He'll beat you.
I still won't beg. They'll have to take me to him. I glanced out of the window. Will you get in trouble if they find me in your crib?
Better that than they find you in here.
She grabbed my wrist.
Come on. They'll search in here soon.
I kicked the oil lamp and the book under a shelf, hiding the evidence. We ran down the dark stone staircase, back into the open. The air smelled crisp, like rain. Liss held me back until the coast was clear. We slipped through the courtyard, under the damp archway, and back onto the broad. The sun shone over the buildings. Liss forced two loose plywood panels apart, and we ducked into the rookery. She steered me past huddles of performers. Their scavenged possessions littered the passages, as if their shacks had been overturned. One boy was propped against the wall, bleeding from the eyes. They whispered in our wake. I ducked into the crib. Julian was waiting, a bowl of skilly balanced on his knee. He looked up when we ducked into the shack.
Morning.
I sat. Glad to see me?
I suppose.
He gave me a smile. If only to remind me how urgently I need to find an alarm clock.
Shouldn't you be inside?
I was just about to go, but now you're here, I'd feel like I was missing the party.
You too,
Liss glared at us.
They take the curfew very seriously, Jules. You're both going to get a right slating.
I ran my fingers through my damp hair. How long until they find us?
Not long.
They'll check the rooms again soon. She sat down.
Why don't you just go?
Every muscle in her body was locked.
It's fine, Liss, I said. I'll take the heat. The bone grubbers are brutal. They won't listen. And I'm telling you now, the warden will kill you if you...
I don't care about him. Liss rested her head in her hand. I looked back at Julian.
His novice's outfit was gone, replaced by a pink tunic.
What did you have to do?
Nishira asked me what I was, he said. I said I was a palmist, but it was obvious I couldn't make anything of her hands. She brought an amorotic into the room, a girl, and had her tied to a chair. I remembered Seb, and asked if she'd let me use water as a scrying pool.
You're a hydromancer.
No, but I didn't want her to know what I am. It was just the first thing that came into my head. He rubbed his head. She filled a golden bowl and told me to look for somebody named Antoinette Carter. I frowned. Antoinette Carter had been an Irish celebrity in the early 40s. I recalled her as middle-aged and thin, as frail as she was enigmatic. She had a TV show, Tony's Truths, which broadcast every Thursday night. She would touch people's hands and claim to see their futures, sounding them out in her deep, measured voice. The show was cancelled after the incursion of 2046, when Cyan had taken Ireland, and Carter had gone into hiding. She still ran an illegal pamphlet, Stingy Jack, which spoke out against Cyan's atrocities. For reasons unknown to us, Jackson had asked a screever called Leon, an expert in sending messages outside Cyan, to make contact with her. I'd never heard the outcome. Leon was a good screever, but it took time to bypass Cyan's security systems. She's a fugitive, I said. She used to live in Ireland. Well, she's not in Ireland now.
What did you see?
I didn't like the look in his face.
What did you tell her?
You're not going to be happy. When he saw my expression, he sighed. I said I'd seen the sundials. I remembered Carl said he'd scried them, and I thought it was believable if I repeated what he'd said. I looked away. Nishira was searching for Jackson. Sooner or later, she'd work out where those dials were. I'm sorry. I could have kicked myself. Julian rubbed his forehead. Why are the sundials so important?
I can't tell you, I'm sorry.
But whatever happens, I glanced at the entrance to the shack. Nishira must never hear of those sundials again. It will put some friends of mine in danger. Liz pulled a blanket around her shoulders.
Paige, she said, I think your friends have been trying to contact you.
What do you mean?
Gumesa took me to the castle for a while.
Her expression grew stiff.
I was in my sail, sorting through my deck for his reading, when I was drawn towards the hanged man. When I picked it up, it was inverted. I saw the ether, the face of a man. He reminded me of Snow.
Nick. Soothsayers always said that about Nick when they saw him, that he was like Snow.
What did he send?
A picture of a phone. I think he's trying to find out where you are.
A phone.
Of course. He didn't know where I was. The gang didn't know I'd been taken by Cyan, though they must have smelled a rat by now. Nick wanted me to call him, to tell him I was all right. It must have taken him days to find the right path through the ether. If he tried again, with a seance, he might be able to send me a message. I couldn't work out why he'd send it to Liz. He knew my aura. It should have been far easier to find. Maybe it was the pills or some kind of interference from the refs, but it didn't matter. He tried to reach me. He wouldn't give up. Julian's voice broke through my thoughts. You really know other jumpers, Paige. When I looked at him, he shrugged. I thought the seventh order was the rarest.
Jumpers. A loaded word. An order of voyants, like soothsayers and augurs. It was the category into which I fell. Those voyants that could affect or enter the ether.
Jax had started the great separation of voyants in the '30s, when he was about my age. It started with On the Merits of Unnaturalness, which had spread like a plague through the voyant underworld. In it, he'd identified seven orders of clairvoyants: soothsayers, augurs, mediums, sensors, furies, guardians, and jumpers. The latter three, he'd written, were vastly superior to the others. It was a novel way of looking at clairvoyance, which had never previously been categorized, but the lower orders hadn't reacted well to it. The resulting gang wars had lasted 2 bloody years. Jax's publishers had finally withdrawn the pamphlet, but the grudges lingered.
Yes, I said. Just one. He's an oracle.
You must be pretty high up in the syndicate.
Quite high up.
Liss ladled a bowl of skilly for me. If she had an opinion on the pamphlet, she didn't voice it.
Jules, she said, could I have a few minutes with Paige?
Of course, Julian said. I'll keep an eye out for the Reds. He left the shack.
Liss looked at the stove. What's wrong? I said.
She drew the blanket closer.
Paige, she said, I'm scared for you.
Why?
I just have a bad feeling about the celebration. You know, the bicentenary. I may not be an oracle, but I see things.
She took out her deck.
Will you let me do your reading? I get the urge to read certain people.
I hesitated. I'd only ever used cards for Taroki.
If you want.
Thanks.
She placed the deck between us.
Have you had your signs read before? By a soothsayer or an augur?
No. I'd been asked many times if I wanted a reading, but I'd never been convinced that peeking into the future was a good idea. Nick sometimes gave me hints, but I usually didn't let him elaborate.
Okay. Give me your hand.
I held out my right hand. Liss grasped it. An expression of intense concentration took over her face, as her fingers dipped into the deck. She removed 7 cards and placed them face down on the floor.
I use the ellipse spread. I read your aura, then pick out 7 cards and interpret them.
Not all broadsiders will give you the same interpretation of a particular card, so don't be too pissed off if you hear something you don't like.
She released my hand.
The first one will indicate your past. I'll see part of your memories.
You see memories?
Liss allowed herself a faint smile. This was something she still took pride in.
Card readers may use objects, but we don't really fit into any category. Even on the merits acknowledged it.
I see that's a good thing. She turned over the first card.
5 of cups, she said. Her eyes closed. You lost something when you were very small.
There's a man with auburn hair. It's his cups that are spilled.
My father, I said.
Yes. You're standing behind him, speaking to him. He doesn't answer. He stares at a picture.
Without opening her eyes, Liss flipped the next card. It was upside down.
This is the present, she said. King of Wands inverted.
Her red lips pursed.
He controls you. Even now you can't escape his hold.
Warden?
I don't think so. Still, he has power. His expectations of you are too high. You're afraid of him.
Jackson.
Nyx is the future.
Liss turned the card. She drew in a sharp breath.
The devil. This card represents a force of hopelessness, restriction, fear. But you've given in to it yourself.
There's a shadow that the devil represents. But I can't see its face.
Whatever power this person will have over you, you will be able to escape it.
They'll make you think you're tied to them forever, but you won't be. You'll just think you are.
Do you mean a partner?
My chest was cold.
A boyfriend? Or is that Warden?
It could be. I don't know.
She forced a smile.
Don't worry. The next card will tell you what to do when the time comes.
I looked down at the 4th card.
The lovers?
Yes. Her voice had dropped to a monotone. I can't see much.
There's tension between spirit and flesh.
Too much.
Her fingers crept towards the next card. External influences.
I didn't know if I could take much more.
So far only one thing had been positive. And even then it was going to be painful. I certainly hadn't expected the lovers.
Death. Inverted. Death is a normal card for voyants. Usually it appears in the past or present positions. But here, inverted. I'm not sure. Her eyes flickered beneath their lids. This far ahead, my sight gets hazy. Things are vague. I know the world will change around you, and you'll do everything in your power to resist it. Death itself will work in different ways. By delaying the change, you'll prolong your own suffering. The sixth card. Your hopes and fears. She picked it up, ran her thumb over it. Eight of Swords. The card showed a woman, bound in a circle of upturned swords. She wore a blindfold. Lissa's skin glowed with sweat. I can see you. You're afraid. Her voice trembled. I can see your face. You can't move in any direction. You can stay in one place, trapped, or feel the pain of the swords. This had to be the most negative spread of cards she'd ever seen. I couldn't stand to see the last card. And the final outcome. Bliss reached for the last card in the spread, the conclusion of the others. I closed my eyes. The ether trembled. I never saw the card. Three people burst into the shack, startling Liss. The bone grubbers had found me.
Well, well, well. Looks like we've sniffed out the fugitive. And her abettor.
One of them seized Liss by the wrist, yanking her to her feet.
Card reading for your guest.
I was just...
You were just using the ether. Privately.
This voice was female, spiteful.
You only read for your keeper one.
I stood. I think I'm the one you want. All three of them turned to face me. The girl looked a little older than me, with long, ragged hair and a prominent brow. The two young men looked so similar they could only be brothers.
True. You are the one we want. The taller of the boys pushed Liss away.
You're going to come quietly, 40.
Depends where you want to take me, I said. Maudlin, you bleach moat. It's past dawn.
I'll walk.
We're escorting you, it's orders.
The girl gave me a really foul look.
You've broken the rules.
Are you going to stop me? Liss shook her head, but I ignored her. I stared the girl out. Her teeth clenched together.
To the honest 16.
16 was the shorter of the two men, but he was burly. He reached out and grabbed my wrist. Quick as a flash, I twisted my arm to the right. His fingers and thumb slipped apart. I jabbed my fist into the hollow of his throat, pushing him into his brother.
I said I'll walk.
16 clutched his throat. The other man lunged at me. I ducked his arm, swung my leg up, kicked his exposed stomach. My boot sank into soft fat, winding him. The girl took me by surprise. She grabbed a handful of my hair and pulled. My head crashed into the metal wall. 16 wheezed with laughter as his brother pinned me to the ground.
I think you need to learn some respect, he said.
He clapped a hand over my mouth, panting.
Your keeper won't mind if I give you a quick lesson.
It's not like he's ever around. His free hand groped my chest. He was counting an easy prey, a helpless girl, not on a mulisher. I cracked my forehead straight into his nose. He cursed. The girl grabbed my arms. I bit her wrist and she shrieked.
You little haybag! Get off her, Catherine!
Liz grabbed her by the tunic, hauling her off me.
What happened to you? Has Crass made you that cruel?
I grew up. I didn't want to be like you, living in my own filth. Catherine spat at her.
You're pathetic. Pathetic Harley scum.
My assailant was sporting an impressive nosebleed, but he wasn't giving up. His blood dripped onto my face. He yanked my tunic, bursting a seam. I shoved at his chest, my spirit close to bursting point. I fought the urge to attack, fought so hard my eyes watered. Then Julian was there. His eye was bloodshot, his cheek freshly cut. They must have reefed him just to reach the shack. His arm wrapped around the boy's neck.
That how you grubbers get your kicks?
It was the first time I'd ever seen him angry.
You only like them when they struggle.
Your bones, 26.
My assailant choked out.
Wait until your keeper hears about this. Tell her, I dare you.
I pulled down my tunic, hands shaking. The Red raised his arms to protect himself. With a single brutal uppercut, Julian socked him in the jaw. Blood spattered the boy's tunic, staining it a shade darker. A chip of tooth slipped from his mouth. Catherine lashed out. The back of her hand caught Liz's cheek, jolting a cry from her lips. The cry startled me. It was Seb's cry all over again. But this time, it wasn't too late. I pushed myself off the floor, intending to tackle Catherine, but 16 took me down at the waist. He was a medium, but he wasn't using spirits. He wanted blood. "Sewell," he roared. The commotion had attracted a group of Harleys. A white jacket stood among them. I recognized him. The boy with cornrows, the Julker. "Get Sewell, you little Tula!" Catherine burst out. She had Liss by the hair. "Get him now!" The boy stood still. He had large, dark eyes with long lashes. Neither of them were infected now. I shook my head at him. "No," he said. 16 let out a bellow. "Traitor!" Some of the performers fled from the word. As I shoved at 16, my skin ran with sweat under my tunic. There was a glow in the edge of my vision. The stove. I stared at the flames creeping along the boards. Liz struggled free from Catherine's grasp. She pushed at 16. Julian dragged him away from us. A thin haze of smoke filled the shack. Liz started to gather her cards, her fingers scraping the deck back together. Catherine pushed her head down, keeping her still. A muffled scream escaped her. "Hey, look," Catherine held out a card to me. "I think this one's for you, 2040. The image showed a man lying on his front, staked by 10 swords. Liz tried to take it back.
"No, that wasn't the..."
"Shut your trap." Catherine pinned her down. I struggled against 16, but he had me in a headlock.
"Useless shit-sayer bitch. You think you've got a hard life? You think it's so hard to dance for them while we're out there getting eaten alive by the buzzers? You didn't have to go back, Kathy. Shut up."
Catherine slammed her head into the floor. She was too angry to care about the fire.
"Every night I'm out in the woods, watching people getting their arms torn off. All to stop the Emin getting in here and ripping your worthless throat out. All so you can sit on your Nancy and play with cards and ribbons. I'll never be like you again, you hear me? The ref saw more in me."
Julian hauled 16 outside. I made a grab for the cards, but Catherine got there first.
"Good idea, 40, she said, almost hysterical with anger. "Let's teach this yellow jacket scum a lesson."
She threw the whole deck onto the fire. The outcome was instant. Liz let out an awful, gut-wrenching scream.
I'd never heard a human being make such a sound.
My hair stood on end. The cards burned up like dry leaves. She tried to grab one, but I caught her wrist. "It's too late, Liz." But she wouldn't listen. She plunged her fingers into the fire, choking, "No, no," over and over. With little fuel but the spilled paraffin, the fire soon went out. Liz was left on her knees, with shiny red hands, staring at the scorched remains. Her face was tinged with grey, her lips with purple. She choked out broken-hearted sobs, rocking on her heels. I cradled her against me, staring numbly at the fire. Her small body heaved. Without her cards, Liz could no longer connect with the ether. She would have to be strong to survive the shock. Catherine grabbed my shoulder.
"That wouldn't have happened if you'd come with us."
She wiped her bloody nose.
"Get up."
I looked at Catherine and pushed the barest edge of my spirit against her mind. She cringed away from me.
"Stay back," I said.
The smoke burned my eyes, but I didn't look away. Catherine tried to laugh, but her nose was starting to bleed.
"You're a freak. What are you, some sort of fury?"
"Furies can't affect the ether." She stopped laughing. A muffled scream came from outside. Sewell shoved his way into the shack, past the terrified performers, He took it all in. The smoke, the disarray. Catherine dropped to one knee and bowed her head. I stood very still. Sewell reached out a hand, grabbed me by the hair, and wrenched my face against his. "You," he said, "are going to die today." His eyes turned red. That's when I knew he meant it. Chapter 15. Fall of a Wall. The day porter stared as Sewell passed, dragging me by the wrist. My throat was raw, my cheeks streaked with blood. He pulled me up the stairs and banged in Warden's door. "Octorus!" A muffled ringing came to my attention. Liss had said Warden would kill me for missing the dawn. What would he make of resisting arrest? The door opened. Warden was there, a massive silhouette against the dim chamber. His eyes were two pinpricks of light. I was rooted to the spot. Having my aura sapped had brought on a kind of fit. I couldn't feel the ether. Nothing. If he tried to kill me now, I couldn't do a thing to stop him. "We found her." Sewell pulled me forward. "Hiding in the rookery. The seditious runt tried to start a fire." Warden looked at each of us in turn. The evidence was clear as glass. Sewell's eyes, my blood-streaked cheeks. "You fed on her," he said. "It is my right to feed on humans. Not on this one. You took far too much. The Blood Sovereign will not be pleased with your lack of restraint." I couldn't see Sewell's face, but I imagined him sneering. In the silence that followed, I coughed. A dry, hacking cough. I was shivering all over. Warden's gaze moved to the rip in my tunic. "Who did this?" I was silent. Warden leaned down to my level. "Who did this?" His voice sent a cold chill through my chest. "A red jacket?" I nodded, just the barest movement of my head. Warden looked up at Sewell. "You allow the red jackets to violate other humans at will? On your watch?" "I care not for their methods. We do not want them breeding, Sewell. We have neither the time nor the means to deal with the pregnancy. The pills sterilize them. Besides, their fornication is for the Overseer to manage." "You will do as I command." "No doubt." Sewell looked down at me with those chilling red eyes. "But back to business. Ask your master for forgiveness, Forty." "No," I said. He cuffed me. I lurched to the side, caught the wall. A prisoner's cinema staggered past my eyes. "Ask your master for forgiveness, 2059-40. You'll have to hit me a lot harder than that." He raised his hand to oblige. Before he could strike, Warden blocked his arm. "I will deal with her in private," he said. "It is not for you to punish her. Wake the Overseer and deal with the commotion. I will not have the sun hours disturbed by this turn of events." They stared at each other. Sewell let out a soft snarl, turned, and was gone. Warden looked after him. After a moment, he took me by the shoulder and steered me into the chamber. His home was the same as it always was. Drapes drawn, fire in the hearth. Gramophone chirping out Mr. Sandman. The bed looked so warm. I wanted to lie down, but I had to stay on my feet. Warden locked the door and sat in his armchair. I waited, still unsteady from the blow. "Come here." I had no choice. Warden looked up at me. Only a short distance. Even sitting down, he was almost my height. Eyes were dim and clear, like chartreuse liqueur. "Do you have a death wish, Paige?" I didn't answer. "I do not care what you think of me, but there are certain rules you must obey in the city. One of them is the curfew." I still didn't speak. He wouldn't have the satisfaction of scaring me. "The red jacket," he said. "What did he look like?" "Dark blonde hair, in his 20s. My voice was rough. "There was a boy that looked a bit like him, 16. And a girl, Catherine. A cold spasm racked my stomach as I spoke. Snitching to a ref felt criminal. Then I pictured Lissa's face, her grief, and my resolve strengthened. I know them. Warden looked into the fire. The two men are brothers, both mediums, 1949-16 and 17. They have been here since they were considerably younger than you. He clasped his hands. I will ensure that they are never allowed to harm you again. I ought to have thanked him, but I didn't. Sit down, he said. Your aura will renew itself. I sank into the opposite armchair. My ribs were beginning to ache and my legs hurt. Warden watched me. Are you thirsty? No, I said. Hungry? No. You must be hungry. The gruel the performers make does far more harm than good. I'm not hungry. It wasn't true. Skilly was little more than water, and my stomach yearned for something thick and warm. A pity. Warden motioned to the nightstand. I had something prepared for you. I'd seen it the second I came in. I'd assumed the plate was for him, but then I remembered what he lived on. Of course the meal wasn't for him. When I didn't move, Warden did. He set the plate across my lap, along with heavy silver cutlery. I looked down at the meal. The sight made my head spin and my throat ache. Soft-boiled eggs, split open to squeeze out a hot gold yolk. A glass dish of pearl barley, tossed with pine nuts and fat black beans that shone like drops of onyx. A skinned pear, soaked in brandy. A sprig of plump red grapes. Whole grain bread with butter. Take it. I clenched my fists. You have to eat, Paige. I wanted so much to defy him, to throw the plate right back at him, but my head was light, and my mouth was spurred with thirst, and all I wanted was to eat the damned food. I picked up the spoon and took a mouthful of the barley. The beans were warm, the nuts brittle and sweet. Relief flooded my body, and the pain in my abdomen began to subside. Warden returned to his seat. He watched in silence as I picked my way through the meal. I felt the weight of his gaze, piercing and delight. When I was finished, I put the plate on the floor. The afterburn of brandy lingered on my tongue. Thank you, I said. I didn't want to say it, but I had to say something. His fingers tapped the arm of his chair. I wish to continue your training tomorrow night, he said. Do you have any objections? I have no choice. What if you did? I don't, I said. So it doesn't matter. I'm speaking hypothetically. But if you had a choice, if you could control your own fate, would you continue your training with me, rather than take your next test cold? My lips were forming a harsh answer when I bit down on my tongue, stopping it. I don't know, I said. Warden stoked the fire. It must be a dilemma. Your morals say no, but your survival instinct says yes. I already know how to fight. I'm stronger than I look. Yes, you are. Your flight from the Overseer was a testimony to your strength. And of course, your gift is a great asset. Even Rephaim will not expect a second spirit to invade the dreamscape. You have the element of surprise on your side. The fire danced in his eyes. But first, you must overcome your limits. There is a reason you find it so difficult to leave your body. Your every move is controlled. Your muscles are constantly locked, ready to run, as if you sense danger in the very air you breathe. It is painful to watch, worse than watching a deer being hunted. A deer, at least, can flee to its herd. He leaned forward. Where is your herd, Paige Mahoney? I had no idea how to answer. I understood what he meant, but my herd, my pack, was Jax and the rest of the gang, and I couldn't breathe a word of their existence. I don't need one, I said. Lone wolf. He wasn't fooled. Who trained you to climb buildings?
Who taught you to fire a gun? Who helped you see farther into the ether, to move your spirit from its natural place? I taught myself. Liar. He reached under his chair. My chest tightened. My emergency backpack. One of the straps hung by a thread. You could have died the night you ran from the overseer. The only reason you did not is because when you lost consciousness, this bag caught on a clothesline, breaking your fall. When I heard of this, I took a personal interest in you. He unzipped the pack. My jaw hardened. Those were my possessions and they're not his.
Quinine,
Warden listed, sifting through the contents. Adrenaline, dexedrine and caffeine. Basic medical supplies, sleep aids. Even a firearm. He held up my pistol. You were remarkably well-resourced on that night, Paige. None of the others were. A shiver ran behind my ribs. No sign of the pamphlet. Either he'd hidden it somewhere, or it had fallen into other hands. Your ID states that you work as an assister, a waitron in an oxygen bar. From what the overseer tells me of Cyan Citadels, payment for that class of job is low. That leads me to believe that you did not purchase these supplies yourself. He paused. So who did? None of your damn business. Did you steal them from your father? I'm not telling you anything more. My life before this place is not yours. Warden seemed to consider this before leveling his gaze on me. You are right, he said. But your life is mine now. My nails dug into the chair. If you are open to the general concept of survival, we will begin training again tomorrow. But there will be a second aspect to your instruction. He nodded to my seat. Every night, you will spend at least 1 hour in that chair, and you will talk to me. The words leapt to my tongue. I'd sooner die. Oh, you are quite welcome to die. I understand that if you smoke too much purple aster, you will be locked into your dreamscape, and your body will shrivel from lack of water. He nodded to the door. Go now, if you choose. Die. Never look upon me again. I see no reason to prolong your suffering. Won't the Blood Sovereign be angry? Perhaps. Do you care? Nashira is my betrothed, not my keeper. She has no influence over how I treat my human charges. And how do you plan to treat me? As my student, not my slave. I turned my head away, my jaw set. I didn't want to be his student. I didn't want to become like him, to turn on my kind, to play on his field. I was starting to feel the ether again, a faint prickling at my senses. If you treat me as your student, I said, then I want to treat you as my mentor, not my master. A fair bargain. But mentors should be shown respect. I expect that from you. And I expect you to stay with me in polite company for 1 hour every night. Why? You have the potential to walk between the ether and the corporeal world at your pleasure, he said. But if you do not learn to be still, even in the presence of your enemies, you will find it difficult. And in this city you will not live very long. And you don't want that. No, I think it a terrible waste of such a singular life. You have great potential, but you do require a mentor. His words twisted around my stomach. I had a mentor. I had Jackson Hall. I'd like to sleep on it, I said. Of course. He stood, and I realized again how tall he was. I didn't even reach his shoulder. Bear in mind that you do have choices, but I advise you, as a mentor, to think of whoever gave you this. With a swing of his wrist, he tossed me the heavy backpack. Would they want you to die for nothing, or would they want to see you fight? Hailstones crashed on the roof of the tower. I rubbed my hands over the paraffin lamp, my lips and fingers numb with cold. I had to consider Warden's offer. I didn't want to work with him, but I had to learn to survive in this place.
at least long enough for me to work out how to get back to London. Back to Nick. Back to Jack's. Back to ducking Jilly's. Back to mime crime. Back to swindling spirits from Didine Waite, taunting Hector and his boys. That was what I wanted. Learning about my gift might just help me get out of this place. Jackson had always said that there was more to being a dream walker than a heightened sixth sense. I had the potential to walk anywhere, even in other dreamscapes. I'd proven it by killing those two underguards. Warden might be able to show me even more. But I didn't want him as a teacher. He and I were natural enemies. There was no point in pretending otherwise. And yet, he had observed so much about me. The way I held myself, my tension, my vigilance. Jax was forever telling me to loosen up, to let myself float. But that didn't mean I could trust the man that kept me locked in this cold, dark room. In the dim light of the lamp, I emptied the backpack. Most of my belongings were still there. The syringes, the equipment, even my gun. No ammo, of course, and the syringes were all empty. My phone had been confiscated. Only one other thing was missing. On the merits of unnaturalness. A cold tingle went through all my muscles. If he'd given it to Nashira, she would have summoned me for questioning by now. The Rephaim must have come across the pamphlet before, but they'd never seen my copy. I lay back on the mattress, minding my bruises, and pulled the sheets up to my neck. Broken springs dug into my shoulders. I'd taken three hits to the head in as many minutes, and I was tired. I looked through the bars to the outside world, wishing the answer could shine through it. But of course, nothing came. Only the inevitable dusk. The night bell tolled when the sun went down. It seemed normal now, like an alarm clock. By the time I'd dressed, I'd come to a delicate decision. I would try to train with him again, if I could stomach it. There was an hour of talking to put up with, but I could handle that. I could fill that hour with lies. Warden was waiting for me at the door. He looked me up and down. "Have you come to a decision?" I kept my distance. "Yes," I said. "I'll train with you. If we agree that you're not my master." "You are wiser than I anticipated." He handed me a black jacket with pink bands on the sleeves. "Wear this. You will need it for your next test." I shrugged it on and buckled it. The lining was thick and warm. Warden held out a hand. In his palm were the three pills. I didn't take them. "What's the green one for?" "That is not your concern." "I want to know what it's for. Nobody else gets it." "That is because you are different from them." He didn't retract his hand. "I know you have not been taking your pills. I have no qualms about force feeding you. I'd like to see you try." His eyes searched my face. My skin prickled. "I do not want it to come to that," he said. I was going to lose this fight. Call it criminal instinct. This was Didine and Anne Naylor all over again. Another day at the black market. There were some things in which Warden would relent. This was not one of them. I told myself I'd take tomorrow's green pill to duck it. I washed down the pills with a glass of water. Warden took my chin in his gloved hand. "There are reasons." I pulled my chin away. He looked at me for a moment, then opened the door. I followed him down the winding steps into the cloisters. Grotesque stone figures watched over the courtyard. The temperature had fallen, coating them in a fine layer of frost. I crossed my arms to preserve some warmth. Warden led me out of the residence, but not onto the street. Instead, he led me to the other side of Magdalen, through a wrought iron gate and across a footbridge, which passed over a Viridian river. The sharp glint of the moon shone on its surface. The hail had stopped, leaving the ground covered in ice. As we walked down a dirt path, Warden rolled up the sleeve of his shirt. The wound from the first time was weeping.
It was beginning to form a scar, but it still hadn't fully healed.
Are they poisonous? I said. Buzzers.
The emim carry an infection called the half-urge, which causes madness and death if left untreated. They eat any kind of flesh, fresh or rotted. Even as I watched, the wound was starting to heal.
How are you doing that?
I asked, forgetting myself and my curiosity.
It's healing.
I am using your aura. I stiffened.
What?
You must know by now that the Rephaim feed on aura. It is easier for me to feed when my host is unaware of it.
You just fed on me?
Yes. He studied my face. You seem angry. It is not yours to take. I moved away from him, disgusted.
You already took my freedom. You have no right to my aura.
I did not take enough to damage your gift. I feed on humans in small doses, allowing time for regeneration. Others are not so courteous. And mark my words. He pulled down his sleeve. You do not want me to contract half-urge in your presence. I looked at his face. He was still, accepting my scrutiny. Your eyes. I looked right into them, mesmerized and repelled at once. That's why they change. He didn't deny it. His eyes were no longer yellow, but a dark, softly glowing red. The color of my aura. I meant no offense, he said. But it must be this way.
Why? Because you said so?
Without responding, he walked on. I followed. It made me sick that he could feed on me. After several minutes of walking, Warden stopped. A thin, blue-tinged mist hung around us. I turned up my collar.
You feel it, Warden said. The cold.
Have you ever wondered why there is frost here, in early spring?
It's England. It's cold.
Not this cold. Feel it. He took my hand and peeled off one of my gloves. My fingers burned in the bitter air. There is a cold spot nearby. I took my glove back.
Cold spot?
Yes. They form when a spirit is welled in one place for a long time, creating an opening between the ether and the corporeal world. Have you never noticed how cold it becomes when spirits are near?
I suppose.
Spirits did chill me, but I'd never given it much thought. Spirits are not supposed to dwell between the worlds. They draw on heat energy to sustain themselves. Sheol One is surrounded by cold spots. Ethereal activity here is much higher than it is in the Citadel. That is why the Emim are attracted towards us, rather than the Amarotic population in London. Warden indicated the stretch of hard earth in front of us. How do you think you might find the epicenter of a cold spot?
Most Voyants could see the spirit, I said. They have the third eye.
But you do not.
No.
There are ways for the unsighted to do it. Have you heard of rhabdomancy?
I hear it's useless, I said.
Jax had told me so, many times. Rhabdomancers say they can find their way back from anywhere. They say they can make Numa fall when they get lost, and that spirits will point them in the right direction.
Doesn't work.
That may be true, but it is not useless. No type of clairvoyance is useless. Warmth rose in my cheeks. I didn't really believe rhabdomancers were useless, but Jax had always told me that they were. You couldn't work for Jackson Hall and not share his opinions on such things.
Why is it useful, then? I asked.
Warden looked at me.
You're supposed to be teaching me.
Teach me.
Very well, if you wish to learn.
Warden started to walk. Most rhabdomancers think that when their Numa fall, they are pointing towards home, towards buried treasure, towards whatever they seek to find. In the end, it makes them mad, because what their Numa point towards is not gold, but the epicenter of the nearest coal spot. Sometimes they walk for miles, and they do not find what they seek. But they do find a something, a secret door. What they do not know is how to open it. He stopped. I was shivering, The air was thin and cold. I breathed deeper, harder. "It is hard for the living to bear a cold spot," he said. "Here." He handed me a silver canteen with a screw cap. I looked down at it. "It is only water, Paige." I drank. I was too thirsty to refuse. He took the canteen back and tucked it away. The water cleared my head. The ground we stood beside was frozen solid, as if it were deep winter. I clenched my chattering teeth together. The spirit responsible for the coal spot was drifting nearby. When it didn't approach us, Warden crouched at the edge of the ice, took out a knife and held it against his arm. I stepped forward. "What are you doing?" "Opening the door." He cut into his wrist. 3 drops of ectoplasm fell onto the ice. The coal spot cracked down the middle, and the air turned white. Shapes gathered around me. Voices. "Dreamer, dreamer." I put my hands over my ears, but it didn't block them. "Dreamer, do not go beyond. Turn back." Then I looked up, and the darkness surrounded me again. "Paige." "What happened?" My head was light and sore. "I opened the cold spot."
"With your blood?"
"Yes." His wrist had stopped dripping already. Red lingered in his eyes. My aura was still working on his wounds. "So you can open a cold spot," I said.
"You can't.
I can. Because cold spots lead to the ether," I paused.
"Can you use them to reach the netherworld?"
"Yes. That is how we got here. Imagine there are 2 veils standing between the ether and your world, the world of life. Between those veils is the netherworld, a medial state between life and death. When Rhabdomancers find a coal spot, they find the means to move between the veils, to enter my home, the realm of the Rephaim.
Can humans go there?"
"Try." I looked up at him. When he nodded to the coal spot, I took a step onto the ice. Nothing happened. "No corporeal matter can survive beyond the veil," Warden said. "Your body cannot pass beyond the gate."
"What about Rhabdomancers?"
"They are still flesh."
"Why open it now, then?"
The sun had disappeared. "Because the time is right," he said, "for you to face the netherworld. You will not go in, but he will see." Sweat began to bead across my forehead. I stepped off the ice. I was starting to sense spirits everywhere. "Night is the time of spirits." Warden looked up at the moon. "The veils are at their thinnest now. Think of coal spots as rips in the fabric." I watched the coal spot. Something about it rattled my spirit. "Paige, you will have 2 tasks tonight," he said, turning to face me. "Both will test the limits of your sanity. Will you believe me if I tell you they will help you?"
"Not likely," I said. "But let's get on with it."
Chapter 16. The Undertaking. Warden didn't tell me where we were going. He led me down another footpath, into the open grounds of Maudlin. I could feel spirits everywhere. In the air. In the water. Spirits of the dead that had once walked here. I couldn't hear them, but with a coal spot open within a mile radius, I could feel them as strongly as if they were living presences. I kept close to Warden in spite of myself. If any of these spirits were malevolent, I sensed he'd be able to repel them more efficiently than I could. The darkness grew deeper as we made our way through the grounds, away from the lanterns of Maudlin. Warden remained silent as we crossed a wet meadow where the lawns had been replaced by knee-deep weeds and grass.
"Where are we going?"
I asked. My boots and socks were already sodden. Warden didn't reply.
"You said I was your student, not your slave," I said.
"I want to know where we're going."
"Into the grounds."
"Why?" No reply again. The night was getting colder, unnaturally cold. After what seemed like hours, Warden stopped and pointed. "There." At first I didn't see it. When my eyes adjusted, the outline of the animal appeared in the dim moonlight. The creature was four-legged, with a silken coat. Its throat was snow-white and its long face narrow, with dark eyes and a small black nose. I wondered which of us looked more astonished. A deer. I hadn't seen one since I'd lived in Ireland, when my grandparents had taken me to the Galtees. A wave of childish excitement swept over me. "She's beautiful," I said. Warden stepped towards the deer. She was tethered to a post. "Her name is Nuala."
"That's an Irish name."
"Yes, short for Finula. It means white shoulders, or fair shoulders." I looked again. There were two large white spots on either side of her neck.
"Who named her?"
In Sion it was risky to give Irish names to pets or children. You might be suspected of sympathizing with the Molly rioters. I did. He released the collar from around her neck. Nuala butted him with her nose. I waited for her to run, but she just stood there, gazing up at Warden. He spoke to her in a strange language, stroking her throat, and she seemed to really listen. She was mesmerized.
"Would you like to feed her?"
Warden slid a red apple from his sleeve. "She has quite a penchant for these." He tossed me the apple. Nuala turned her gaze on me, nose twitching. "Gently," Warden said. "She is easily startled with a cold spot open nearby." I didn't want to startle her, but if Warden didn't, how could I? I held out my hand, presenting the apple. The doe sniffed at the fruit. Warden said something else, and she snatched it. "Forgive her. She's very hungry." He patted her neck and gave her another apple. "I rarely have the chance to see her."
"But she lives in Magdalen."
"Yes, but I must be careful. Animals are not permitted within the limits of the city."
"So why keep her?"
"For company. And for you."
"For me?"
I repeated. "She's been waiting for you." He sat down on a flat rock, letting Nuala wander off towards the trees. "You are a dreamwalker. What does that mean to you?" He hadn't brought me out here to feed a baby deer. "I'm attuned to the ether," I said. "Say more. I can sense other dreamscapes at a distance, and ethereal activity in general."
"Precisely.
That is your nascent gift, the bottom line, a heightened sensitivity to the ether, an awareness that most other clairvoyants do not possess. It comes from your silver cord, which is flexible. It allows you to dislocate your spirit from the center of your dreamscape, to widen your perception of the world. It would drive most clairvoyants mad to do that. But when we trained on the meadow, I encouraged you to push your spirit against my dreamscape. To attack it." His eyes smoldered in the gloom. "You have the potential to do more than merely sense the ether. You can affect it. You can affect other people." I didn't answer. "Perhaps when you were younger, you could hurt people. Perhaps you could put pressure on the dreamscapes. Perhaps they noticed things. Nosebleeds, distorted vision."
"Yes."
He already knew. No point in denying it. "Something changed on the train," he continued. "Your life was endangered. You feared detainment. And for the first time in your life, that power inside you, that power emerged."
"How did you find out?"
"A report came through that an underguard had been killed. Killed without blood, without weapons, without a single mark on his body. Nishira knew at once that it was the work of a dreamwalker. It could have been a poltergeist. Poltergeists always leave a mark. You should know." The scars on my hand seemed to drop a few degrees. "Nishira wanted you alive," Warden said. "The NVD makes clumsy, violent arrests, as do many of our red jackets. Around half of those arrests end in death. That could not happen with you. You had to be unspoiled. That was why Nishira sent the Overseer, a specialist procurer of clairvoyance."
"Why?"
"Because she wants to learn your secret."
"There is no secret. It's what I am."
"It is also what Nishira wants to be. She longs for rare gifts, including yours."
"Why doesn't she take it then? She could have killed me when she murdered Seb. Why the wait?"
"Because she wants to understand the full extent of your abilities. But she will not wait forever. I won't perform for you, I said. I'm not a Harley yet. I did not ask you to perform for me. Where is the need? I saw your ability in the chapel. You forced your spirit into Eludra's mind. I saw it on the meadow when you broke into mine. But tell me, he leaned towards me, his red eyes hot in the dark. Could you have possessed either of us? There was a tense silence, broken only by the reedy screech of an owl. The sound made me look up. I looked at the moon, cradled in a smoking cup of cloud. For a brief moment, I was taken back to Jax's office, the first time we'd broached the subject of possession. My dear girl, he had said, you've been a star, nay, a luminary. You are absolutely and indubitably a keeper, a seal fit to burst. But now I would like to give you a new task. A task that will test you, but also fulfill you. He asked me to force my mind into his, to see if I could take control of his body. The idea had shaken me. I'd given it a half-hearted try, but the complexity of his mind had been too much to fathom. All well, he had said, with a puff of his cigar. It was worth a try, oh my lovely. Away with you now. There are broads to spread and games to play. Maybe I could have done it. Maybe if I'd really wanted to, I could have seized Jax's body and stubbed out that bloody cigar. But it was that very ability that frightened me. To control someone was a serious responsibility, too serious for me. Even with the promise of a pay rise. I would wander through the mind of London, but I would never seize control of it. Not for all the money in the world. Paige? I surfaced from my memories. No, I said. I couldn't have possessed Eludra, or you. Why not? I can't possess people, and I definitely can't possess refs. Would you like to? No. You can't make me do it. I do not intend to force you. I am merely presenting you with an opportunity to broaden your horizons, as you say, by causing pain. If possession is performed well, it should not cause any pain. I do not expect you to possess a human, certainly not tonight. Then what do you want? He looked across the field. I followed his line of sight. The doe was scuffing her hoof against some flowers, watching them bob their heads. Nuala, I said. Yes. I watched the doe bend her head and snuffle at a patch of grass. I'd never considered practicing possession on animals. Animal minds were very different to human minds. Less complex, less conscious. But that might make it harder. It might not even be possible for me to fit my human spirit into an animal body. Would I think like a human when I had an animal dreamscape? And then there were other concerns. Would it hurt the deer? Would she struggle against my infiltration? Or let me straight in? I don't know, I said. She's too big. I might not be able to control her. I will find something smaller. What exactly do you want out of this? When he said nothing, I continued. You're pretty pushy for someone who claims to be giving me an opportunity. I want you to take this opportunity. I do not deny it. Why? Because I want you to survive. I held his gaze for a moment, trying to read him. I couldn't. There was something about refite faces that discouraged emotional guesswork. Fine, I said. A smaller animal, an insect, a rodent, maybe a bird. Something with limited sentience. Very well. He was about to turn away when he stopped. With a glance in my direction, he removed something from his pocket, a pendant on a thin chain. Wear this, he said. Why? But he was gone. I sat down on the edge of a small boulder, fighting a shiver of anticipation. Jax would be nodding his approval, but I wasn't sure Nick would be doing the same. I looked down at the pendant. It was about as long as my thumb, woven into the shape of wings. As I brushed my finger over it, there was a tiny tremor in the ether. It must have been sublimed. I pulled the chain over my head. Nuala returned after a while, having grown bored of the grass. I was huddled against the boulder, my hands deep in the pockets of my jacket. It was extraordinarily cold now, and my breath came in white clouds.
Hello,
I said. Nuala sniffed at my hair, like she was trying to work out what it was, then bent her legs and huddled next to me. She laid her head in my lap and made a sort of contented huff. I pulled off my gloves and stroked her ears. Her coat smelled of musk. I could feel her heartbeat, thick and strong. I'd never been this close to a wild animal. I tried to imagine what it must be like to be this little doe, to stand on four legs, to live wild in the woods. But I wasn't wild. I'd lived in a Saiyan citadel for over a decade. All the wildness had gone out of me. That was why I'd joined Jax, I supposed, to cling to what was left of my old self. After a moment, I decided to test the water. I closed my eyes and let my spirit drift. Nuala had a permeable dreamscape, thin and frail as a bubble. Humans built up layers of resistance over the years, but animals didn't have all that emotional armor. In theory, I could control her. I gave her dreamscape the lightest of nudges. Nuala let out a snort of alarm. I stroked her ears, shushing her. Sorry, I said. I won't do it again. After a moment, she laid her head back on my lap, but she was quivering. She didn't know it was me that had hurt her. I ran my fingers under her chin, scratching gently. By the time Warden returned, I was half asleep. He roused me with a tap on the cheek. Nuala looked up, but Warden soothed her with a word, and she soon dozed off again. Come, he said. I have found you a new body. He sat on the boulder. I was struck by how he'd looked under the moon. Perfectly outlined, strong-featured, with a radiance to his skin. What is it? I said. See for yourself. His hands were caged, fingertips just touching. I looked down at the fragile insect. A butterfly, or a moth. Hard to tell in the darkness. It was quiescent when I found it, he said. It is still lethargic. I thought it would make it easier. A butterfly, then. It was twitching in his hands. Cold spots frighten animals. His voice was a soft rumble. They can sense an open conduit to the netherworld. Why did you open it? You will see. He raised his gaze to meet mine. Are you willing to attempt a possession? I'll try, I said. His eyes glowed hotter, like coals. You probably already know this, I said. But my body's going to fall when I leave it. I'd appreciate if you could catch me. I had to choke the words out. I hated asking him for a favor, even something so small and obvious. Of course, Warden said. I broke the eye contact first. After a deep breath, I dislodged my spirit. At once my senses blurred, and I could see my dreamscape. I could already feel the ether. It grew stronger as I walked towards the edge of the poppy field, where it was dark. The ether was there, waiting for me. I jumped. I could see my silver cord, unraveling from my dreamscape, giving me a way to return. Warden's dreamscape was close. The butterfly was only a dot beside it, a grain of sand beside a marble. I slid into its mind. There was no reactive jerk, no sudden panic from my host. I found myself in a world of dreams, a world of color, washed in ochre light. The butterfly spent its days feeding on flowers, and their opulent colors made up all its memories. Ambrosial scents wafted from everywhere, lavender and grass and roses. I paced through the dewy dreamscape, heading for the brightest part. Pollen swirled from the flower-laden trees, catching in my hair. I'd never felt so free. There was no resistance, not even the faintest flinch of a defense mechanism. It was so painless, so easy and beautiful. Like I'd stepped out of a heavy set of shackles. It felt natural. This was what my spirit longed to do, to wander in strange lands.